Most people think it's BS, but it actually happened. And we got this guy really, really hammered one day, and he went into HR and had his exit interview and got really, really, really belligerent, which is unfortunate, and then ran out of the studio yelling and screaming, doing all these things, and passed out in the middle of the median of a freeway.
Welcome to the D3 Podcast, Drunk Developer Diaries. We're at the bar, so pull up a stool, grab a beer, and listen in as we talk to video game industry professionals to answer all your questions about how video games are made, how you might be able to get into the industry should you be so inclined, and hopefully learn a little bit about their career along the way. I'm Ryan, your host.
And I'm your co-host and producer, Jeremy. Now, our goal is to be as open and honest as possible on this show, but we are speaking with people in an industry that's got a lot of secrets. You sign a lot of NDAs, don't you, Ryan?
Oh, yes.
And since we're drinking here at the bar, it's totally possible that some slip-ups might occur, so any edits or bleeps are due to the team of lawyers who, unfortunately, we have to abide by.
Alrighty, well, tonight on the podcast, we have Rich Lambert. Rich is the creative director for Elder Scrolls Online at ZeniMax Online in Hunt Valley, Maryland. Rich, how you doing?
Good man.
Rich is a video game designer extraordinaire, and his history stretches way back to the QA pits at EA Canada in the mid-90s. This is the Drunk Developer Diaries podcast, so let me start with the most important question. What are you drinking tonight, Rich?
I am drinking doggy style, pale ale.
Oh, all right. Well, he's a beer guy like we are. But let's start with some of the history here. We wanted to get to know a little bit about you. So first off, where are you from?
I'm from Vancouver, BC, right. So I'm Canadian.
I spent some time up there myself, actually. So did you grow up with video games? Was it a goal to get into video games? How did you start?
So I'm definitely a gamer.
All right.
Definitely, like, love games. I think Yara's Revenge was probably the game that, like, this is what I want to play all the time. And truth be told, I had no idea that this was a real industry when I got into it. Like, I went to school to golf. That's what I did. Like,
wait, you were going to be a golfer?
I was going to be a golf pro. That was my thing.
Wow.
And I didn't like school, but I loved golf. And the school I went to gave me a golf bag and gave me free access to the range and free access to the golf course. And that's what I wanted to do at the time. And then 1 year between semesters, my buddy got a job at EA testing video games. And I was like, what the hell is that? That's a bullshit thing. And sure enough, it was a real thing.
So I actually got involved in the industry in, I think 91 through a QA department as well. But a lot of people I know in the industry started that way. So what, back in that day, first off, what did you work on and what were you doing as a QA guy? What did your day look like? I think a lot of people think that QA is getting to sit around and play video games, but it's not nearly as glamorous as that sounds.
It's not. And I gave up trying to explain to my parents what a QA tester was. And even today, I still kind of give up and just say, yeah, I play video games all day. But my first game that I ever tested was FIFA SNES.
Oh, nice.
So way, 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 way back then. And most of my day was go into this one game mode, do this thing over and over and over and over and over. Until either A, I broke it, or B, it worked.
That's got to get boring after a while, right?
It can. It can be pretty monotonous at times. But for me, because I love games so much and I had no idea this was a real thing, I was learning all the time. And I think that's the big key is I had that passion and that drive and that desire to go in and play and just kind of see how things were going. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you find really crazy things. We used to destroy dev kits.
Really?
Accidentally, yeah. Triple play, you know, way back in the day, we found a bug. I don't remember who found it, but it actually overwrote something in the BIOS in the dev kit.
Sure.
And so the dev kit was toast when we reproduced the bug. And we did it like three times and destroyed three $30,000 machines.
Yeah, those things were not cheap back in the day. They're still not cheap.
Right.
Now, for those who don't know, you're talking about the like the code, the core code of the machine, right, has been rewritten in some fashion that
there was some kind of memory override and it just destroyed the machine.
Wow, that's not supposed to happen.
Nope.
Yeah, it does sometimes. we've set a few things on fire throughout the course of my career as well. So where did you go? You're at EA in the QA department. Were you at QA the entire time you were there? Did you make
pretty
it
much
the design?
Okay. No, I was in QA for 6-7 years.
Wow.
And I got to test a ton of stuff, got to see how a whole bunch of different teams did things. And so for me, that was, again, another one of those learning experiences. And I didn't at the time understand that that's what I was doing, but I got to see all of these different things. And then when I moved into production later, that was when I started going, oh, I understand there's this design thing, and then there's, you know, there's all this other magical stuff that's a part of building games that I didn't know as a QA person.
So now being at EA, I was at EA a long time ago as well, and I think a lot of younger people have probably heard the stories of crunch mode back in those days.
Diddy crunch?
Did you have any experiences with that, of sleeping under your desk?
I did. My first contract at EA was part-time over 25 hours.
Oh, all right.
Okay. And that was what they did way back in the day. And I worked probably 80 hours a week most weeks. I have horror stories of working 3 24-hour shifts in a week.
Oh, yeah.
Just crunching through all that stuff. There's definitely some. It was a different industry back then. We've matured a little bit, or I'd like to think we've matured a little bit since then.
I certainly hope so. I remember I had 188-hour two-week period once, and it was I was making, I think, $550 an hour, and it was my first over $1,000 paycheck. And
yeah,
man,
like,
man.
Don't get me wrong, I loved it because I was a college kid.
Yeah.
I lived at home at the time. I had no responsibilities. So, yeah, I ended up, you know, my first 2 years at EA, I was working crazy hours, mm-hmm. and so I didn't have a social life, but I had a motorcycle, I had a car.
You're living the dream.
I did. I mean, at really. The time. I thought it was the most amazing thing in the world, and I was young and dumb and didn't know any better.
Well, first thing I did was go down to Guitar Center in San Diego and blow it all on a speaker cabinet. Oh, man, it was amazing. Well, how did you make it out of QA then? You said you're at QA your entire time at EA. Where did you go from there?
I actually left the games industry for a little while and went to a startup company to test auction software.
Fascinating.
It wasn't. a good friend of mine, you know, brought me over there and you know, we did our thing, and the company ended up shutting down, so I went back to EA for a bit. And then EA let me go because I didn't fit in anymore.
Oh.
Which, that's a whole other story that I probably haven't had enough beer yet to talk about.
You had been there a long time. I mean, that's...
Well, I'd come back.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
I was kind of, you know, maturing at the time as well and changing. So, I ended up moving to Oklahoma.
Really?
To go work at a company called 2015.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were... they used to do Call of Duty, right?
They did Medal of Honor.
Medal of Honor. Sorry, my bad.
Medal of Honor? The game I worked on while I was there was Men of Valor Vietnam, but they did the multiplayer portion of Men of Valor, and that was when I got my first taste at production.
That's and one hell of a technology hub, by the way. That must have been.
It was... they thought I was actually a spy from EA at the time, which is kind of funny because I'd been at EA and they were, you know, they had been under contract by EA to make Medal of Honor. You know, I kind of won them over and spent some time working on that. And I was a producer, ultimately responsible for their QA department and a lot of the voiceover work. And then because we didn't have a lot of multiplayer experience, I did some of the multiplayer design and whatnot with the level designers there. And I fell in love with design at that point.
Well, let me back up just a little bit, because you said you were a producer for a while. I think I have about 100 friends who are producers.
Uh-huh.
And if I asked them what a producer does, I would probably get 150 different answers.
Yep.
So maybe for some of the people who are listening, thinking about getting into the industry, what in your mind does a producer do? What's that role like?
It depends.
Thank you, yes.
Right? You know, very nebulous answer, but it depends on where you're at. So at EA and some of the other companies I've worked at, a producer is kind of that final say in a lot of the design decisions. Mm-hmm. They're responsible for a lot of the scheduling and managing of the team and making sure that the team has everything they need in order to build the things they need to build. Mm-hmm. At some places, they just are the keepers of the schedules, and then there's a designer or a lead designer or somebody that is responsible for more of the day-to-day design decisions and whatnot.
Yeah, I know when I was at EA in, I think about 2000, we didn't even have designers. We only had producers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they definitely did a lot of the organizational stuff, but also a lot of the yep. design. So that's certainly not the way the entire industry works. But
no, it's different everywhere you go.
Yeah, yeah. So all
right. Is every sort of like company a little different in the way they structure their crew and their employees? And yep. when you move from one to another, is there a little bit of a learning curve to figure out what the hell is going on?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually insane. I mean, the different positions mean different things, and even even the core language. Like, we don't do a great job of kind of defining a core language of our industry. So a term that might mean one thing in one company
means nothing or something
different.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we're still very much in our infancy when you look at that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Every time, every new company I go to, I'd spend the first 2 weeks just nodding my head and pretending.
Having no idea what's going on.
No. Right. I'm like, all right, I'll pretend that I know what that means.
You fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. That's the story of my life.
Yeah.
So you're at 2015 and you got into design there. Were you then on the hunt for a full-time design gig?
At the time, no. But ultimately what happened was 2015 kind of shattered. And then we were left with the, holy cow, we're in Oklahoma. Where do we go? What do we do? And I found another production position. And I had my choice kind of between Chicago Midway and Bethesda.
All right.
And my wife and I kind of went back and forth. And we ended up choosing Bethesda, which was ultimately a really good choice because I've been with Bethesda for 13 years now.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've been with ZeniMax Online before there was a ZeniMax Online.
I was. And there's a really cool story about that, too.
So, you get to Bethesda, and, how does all that happen? Tell us that cool story, if you can.
I totally can.
I'm ready to beep it out if you can't.
No. I've told the story before, too, so it's fine. So when I got to Bethesda, I was responsible for managing their kind of satellite studio. And we ultimately turned into the technology group for the studio, the group that was responsible for getting Oblivion to work on consoles. Hmm. But kind of before then, I worked on IHRA drag racing. I worked on Star Trek Encounters. You know, a couple of console games before then.
A couple of games that Bethesda is not really known for nowadays.
Correct. But then Oblivion hit, and we had this really, really strong core art and technology group. And they were there because they opened the studio just for that group. They lived in Pennsylvania. They couldn't really, handle the commute from Pennsylvania all the way down to Rockville all the time.
Yeah, that's what, an hour and a half?
At least.
Worse with traffic?
Yep. And so they didn't want to lose those guys, so they opened the studio. They brought me in to kind of manage that studio, and we did that for a while. And then all throughout the two and a half years, whatever it was, I would kind of pester Todd Howard every once in a while. I'd be like, hey, you know what would make a really great MMO? Elder Scrolls would make a great MMO. And Todd would be like, yeah, whatever. And then one day, I ended up driving down for my kind of weekly, sync up with the team. And Todd called me into his office, and Matt Fierer was sitting in his office next to him.
So Matt Fierer is the game director.
He is the game director and president of ZeniMax Online Studios. Mm-hmm. And Todd was like, Rich, this is Matt. Matt, this is Rich. Matt, please take Rich. All he talks about is making an MMO, and you want to make an MMO. Please take him. And Matt and I talked for a couple hours, and it turned out it was a hit, and he hired me basically on the spot.
So Matt came from Dark Age of Camelot, right?
He did.
Which is still one of the high-ranking MMOs that I see on all the lists.
It is. It's one of those games that, especially from the PvP side of things, the player versus player where you get to kill other players kind of thing, it's way up there. So he is of that.
Okay, so you have the Dark Age of Camelot guy and you the producer designer from Bethesda.
Yep.
So, I mean, I don't know if anybody listening knows Elder Scrolls Online right now, but it's a huge game, and it was in development for years.
Yeah. How 2007.
How many people right now play that game?
Oh, boy. I don't know. Lots?
Yeah, I guess.
It's definitely
It's in the millions. I think last year we announced we had over 10 million players that have played the game.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Yeah, and you know, obviously some players come and go and whatever, but I think the daily numbers are still
they're
pretty
up
attractive.
There. Yeah. Yeah, we're doing well.
So how does that start? It's you two staring at each other in a room. What does that look like?
Basically, like it was hiring the team up. You know, obviously.
So, well, from a design point of view, because I think you know, I get a lot of questions from people who want to get into video games, and I think a lot of people think they're going to walk into a company with a great idea for a game, and they I don't know, yell at programmers.
The idea man.
Yeah. How does that work? You have an IP of Elder Scrolls.
Yep.
And do you look at other big MMOs at the time, or you know, how do you take that from an idea of kind of an intellectual property to actually what the game is going to be?
It's definitely not an easy process, right? I think the big things are, you know, you have to understand what it is you're trying to create. You know, we knew we wanted to be an MMO. We definitely had lots of stops and starts, but our core values were in the spirit of Elder Scrolls. That was our biggest thing. What does Elder Scrolls mean? And so we spent a lot of time kind of trying to dissect what Elder Scrolls meant.
Okay.
And we opened the studio in 2007.
So that was pre-Skyrim days, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So we had a concept of what Elder Scrolls was at the time. And then Skyrim came out and we were like, whoa. Okay, so we have to rethink some of these things, and we kind of went through a little bit of a reboot and kind of, you know, refocused our efforts on certain things, and then we launched. And our launch, you know, admittedly wasn't as strong as it probably should have been. And the beauty of ZeniMax is they see talent, they understand talent, they know they have a strong IP in Elder Scrolls, and they were like, make this right, guys. Go in and make it right. And so that's what we did. We went through and we focused really hard on what are the core values of Elder Scrolls? What are the things that players and our community are telling us aren't quite hitting the mark, aren't quite hitting that bar? And we went in and we fixed them all. And we adjusted and we changed all that stuff. And now it's 2018 and we have a ton of people playing the game and we're really successful.
So when was that? When was the initial launch of ESO?
2014. 4/4/14.
4/4/14. Okay, so it had been
Says that on the back of my jacket.
So it's 7 years from initial kind of concept to actually shipping the game.
It took us a while.
Yep. And then it's another year to tweak things and get things.
Yep. Console launch was kind of our next chance at showing everybody what the game was. And that was a really good thing for us.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, after making all those tweaks and then hitting on Xbox and PS4, you probably opened it up to a whole new market of people
Absolutely.
Who don't play on PC. So, well, let me back up a little bit to some of the history, because you mentioned Todd Howard and that you were pretty close with him at one point. Todd, of course,
I pestered him. I don't know if I was close to him.
Okay, all right.
And if you ask him, he'd be like, yeah, that guy was an asshole.
So, you know, this is one of the legendary names in our industry. He's had, what, 5 games of the year in a row? I don't know.
5 game of the years in a row, I think, that studio.
Yeah.
And most of that team has been together since Morrowind.
So what did you learn from him? Because, you know, there aren't too many game makers that are well known, but he's probably one of them.
He's
probably one of
the
best.
He's a brilliant guy, but he's also super humble.
Yeah, yeah. I've always known him to be incredibly nice.
And he strikes you as somebody that is very unassuming. Like, he doesn't go around saying, I'm Todd Howard, I'm the man, right? Like, that's not what he is. He's very unassuming. He sits down and he listens to people. But he also has this knack of telling or describing to people his ideas and his themes. And then because the team has been together for so long, they just kind of know what he thinks.
Okay.
And so I think he's told the story a couple of times where he's like, I want Skyrim to be this, and he points to like a really cool doll on his or an action figure on his desk, and the team goes, okay. And they go off and they start working. And then obviously there's some, you know, course correction and iteration over the time. But that's how that team works. They work very closely together, and it's unbelievable.
That is amazing. I remember I was at Nintendo for a long time in the 90s, and one of the old school game maker guys from Nintendo came into our department, and he said, okay, for the next six months, I just want you to think about how a flower grows and the concept of rumor.
Yep.
And I had no idea what he was talking about.
What are you talking
about?
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's the designer problem, right?
Yeah.
Explain what a door is.
Yep.
Right? And when you think about it, to most people, a door is that thing that I open and close. But to a designer or to an artist or to a programmer is, what color is it? What sounds does it make? How quickly does it open? How quickly does it close? Is there mass to it? Like, all of these other questions come out.
Yeah.
You don't think about that stuff as a normal person.
Sure. And I know I come from the tech background of that, and there's a whole set of technical questions for
absolutely.
That. How do you get the guy to line up with the door? How does the door not go through the guy? How do you make it look real?
Yep. Can the player walk through the door?
Yeah, can the player close the door? Is this
all
door
those
of
questions.
Physics? Yeah, it gets off into the weeds pretty quickly.
Yep.
So let me ask you a little bit more about the history of ESO in the studio. So you said did you start as creative director on the project?
Didn't.
Okay. So what was your role?
I originally started as a producer.
Okay.
And kind of went through that process for a while and decided while we were still kind of hiring people up that I really, really wanted to be a designer. And so Matt and I talked a lot, and he ended up making me the lead dungeon designer.
Okay.
And then from there, I went from dungeons to content designer, and I was the lead content designer for a long time, and I had a bunch of teams that were responsible for building all the quests in the game. And the zones and kind of how all that worked. And then from there, I moved into my creative director role, and I've been there for a number of years now.
Okay. Oh, so when you're designing a dungeon, what does that look like? I mean,
it's different now than it was then.
Well, I'm sure. But I mean, do you start with the dungeon layout? Do you start with kind of the concept of where the enemies are placed or what the end goal is?
Yeah, ultimately, what I started with was, what is the story we want to tell? Because storytelling is the biggest part of any kind of game. Is what is the story you want to tell? How do you want to show it? How do you want to tell it? And from there, you take the story, and then you go into the layout.
Now, when you say story, do you mean the
is that like the lore of everything?
It is. It's all of that.
Encompasses that.
It's. Yeah. Develop the background lore of the area, but then what is the story you want the player to experience?
So it's kind of
the
narrative arc of what they're going to see, and what's the hero's journey through this dungeon.
Right. And way back in the day, at the time, we didn't really have level designers. We didn't have a lot of world builders. And so what my job was to lay out the entire dungeon. And I built a dungeon out of these little 1 meter by 1 meter blocks. The entirety of a dungeon.
And was this using like a commercial modeling package, or was it using an internal editor?
No, it was our internal editor.
Okay, all right. At the time. So you're literally laying out blocks.
Literally laying out blocks, stretching things. At the time, we could scale, you know, shapes.
That's kind of what Minecraft is, right?
Kind of, sort of. Without the scaling.
Without the stretching, yeah.
And yeah, we would build that out. And then once we had the rough layout, we would populate it with monsters. And then we would play test it. And we would kind of go through and see, does this work? How does this work? How does this feel? Are the encounters cool?
So you do all that before you polish it, before
absolutely.
You go back and
yep.
spend any of that time that's yep. probably needed with all the
yep.
texturing.
We call that gray boxing.
Yeah, okay.
So you go in, you kind of build the rough layout, you figure out run times is another big thing when you're going through there. How long do you want this dungeon
yeah.
to take? How
yep.
long do you want this experience to take? And literally, you are there with a stopwatch, and you're running through without monsters. Well, it takes this long to run through without monsters. Now I put monsters in there, and I go through. How long does it take me to kill every monster in there? And then you start going through there, and you're like, okay, this is what a simple run is. What about traps? How do you do that kind of stuff? Do you put jumping puzzles in the game? Do you, you know, do these
nobody
individual
likes
encounters?
Jumping puzzles.
It depends on the engine, and depends on the game. But yeah, I agree with you. You know, nobody likes jumping puzzles.
I don't know. I'm a tech guy. I'm just repeating what I hear. I don't want to implement jumping. So when you took over as creative director, uh-huh. So here's another thing I kind of wanted to ask you about, because again, people that I talk to, they want to get in, they want to design their game. They have
right.
they have a game that they've thought through for probably 5-10 years that they want to make.
Mm-hmm.
And that just rarely happens.
Yeah.
So yes. You're sitting here as a producer, and now somebody says, okay, go, you're the creative director. You're saddled with somebody else's vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do you work with that? Do you try to make it your own vision?
Or do you tell them to beat it? You got a better idea.
I'm sure the financial guys love that. We're going to burn down 4 years of development.
I think it depends on the situation you're in as well and how established the game is that you're working on. But I'm a firm believer of you have to kind of play the thing you're working on, eat your own dog food, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I'm really passionate about on Elder Scrolls Online is I play the crap out of the game.
Yeah, I do know. You know everything about the game. I've been
not
impressed.
Everything.
Well, I've been impressed sitting with you and hearing you know all the lore. You know all the character names. You know how everything fits together. What the plots are. What the history of the world is.
Right.
You know everything about the world. You're not just designing puzzles.
Right.
You have the whole vision of what.
I definitely try. It's hard, but you only get that by playing the thing that you're working on. And if you don't love the thing you're working on, other people aren't going to love the thing you're working on.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. I think, you know, me from the tech side, I'm a little more detached from things there because I see the ones and zeros. I see the, I see the mechanics. I see the tools. I see all that. And
where's your love, Ryan?
it's in the steely,
Matrix.
Yeah, it's in the steely gray heart somewhere. We'll find it one of these days. But so as creative director, I mean, what is your daily job? What do you do?
I go to meetings a lot.
you do sit in a lot of meetings, but you also evangelize the game. You do a lot of press, right?
I do kind of bits of everything. So I'm lucky enough to have a really strong team around me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can kind of work with the individual components of the team and kind of say, here's the box. Here's what I'm thinking. How do you translate that into something that's good?
Mm-hmm.
And I have these really smart people that go in and are able to do that. And then I'm able to, like you said, evangelize the game, talk with press, talk mm-hmm. with our various community representatives and make sure that people understand just how good the game is and how different it is from everything else out there.
Yeah, I think most people don't realize they don't put us in front of cameras very often. So
we
tend to be reclusive and
well,
kind
we're
of
all
odd.
Nerds, yeah, right? Oh, yes. And I say that in the I am absolutely one of those.
Yeah.
You know, I am a total nerd. I got into the industry because I wasn't good with people.
Yeah, I hear that. I spent years in my bedroom programming a computer.
Right. And so it's actually really cool to be able to go to a convention or go to a show. And sit down and talk with other people that are very much like me. They love the game. They love talking about the game. You don't have to feel kind of self-conscious about loving the game.
Well, obviously this podcast is going to air. We don't know when it's going to air, actually, but it'll be a while. But next week you're off to GDC.
I am.
So you have a bunch of press to do. So if anybody listening to this, I would encourage you to look up Rich Lambert at GDC 2018.
Oh, don't do that.
to see what kind of stuff he's announcing. I'm sure it's exciting. Let me ask you one more question, then I'm taking a beer break because I'm actually
Please.
Dry.
Yep.
But tell me about the breakdown of your team. I think, you know, again, design is something a lot of people want to get into. I've actually spoken recently at a few universities with students in programming departments. And I sit in front of 60 students and I ask them, you know, how many want to be programmers? And these are programming students.
Uh-huh.
And five raise their hand. And I ask them how many people want to be designers. And it's the rest of the class. They're
right.
All programming.
Everybody's
to be designers.
An idea person.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think most people have a grasp on what are the different design positions. It's not just one guy that dictates
it's
everything. It's a whole department
of people. It's a team. And some of it depends on the structure of the company and kind of how it's laid out. But at ZeniMax, we have content designers who are responsible for kind of the scripting and implementation of a lot of the quests in the game.
Okay, so they build the world. They build what you're going to do.
They build the quest content.
Sorry, yes, you're right. Yes, okay.
Right, which is right. Something. And then we have writer designers who are responsible for making words good, which obviously I'm not very good at.
Some have a way with words and some have not way.
Absolutely. And then we have systems designers who are responsible for doing more of the systems in the game. So like a fishing system or like a friend system or a guild system, all of those things that kind of encompass those other social mechanisms and whatnot in the game. Then we have combat designers, and they're responsible for a lot of the class and the class balance and the different abilities that they put in. And we have a monsters team who's responsible for building monsters, just how monsters react in the world and the things that they do.
So, and this is actually separate from how monsters look, right? There's a whole art team.
There's a whole other art team that does all that other stuff, and that's broken down into the actual modeling of the monsters, to the rigging of the monsters, to the animating of them, and so on and so forth. It's really complex.
So we plan on the D3 podcast to have a lot of different people from a lot of different areas. So we'll hopefully here soon we'll get more into the art side of things and even into the programming of that if people are interested.
Yeah,
I think so.
It's I'd be really cool.
That. Yeah,
it's really really cool.
Now I don't know if it's actually on your team, but ZeniMax Online actually has a person who is the lore master, right?
We do, and he is on my team.
Is this like one guy?
Literally
tucked away with encyclopedias of information surrounding him.
He literally looks like a wizard.
I mean, that's how I'm imagining him right now. So,
he is awesome. Yeah. And it pisses me off because he has the best voice and he can read, and he could read the phone book to somebody.
Oh, really?
And people would just swoon.
Yeah.
But he's responsible for all of the plot points in the game, right? Making sure.
He makes sure that everything we do fits within the Elder Scrolls universe.
Okay. Yeah, I had a friend
without being a dick, I'm sure, right? Like, you know,
he's got he's a wizard. Yeah. How can you be mad at him, right?
Yeah, of course.
I had a friend who made quite a few of the Star Wars games for LucasArts, and he said that was one of the most amazing things, which I don't even think it was one guy, I think it was three guys. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong, but who controlled the Star Wars universe, right? And anything, whether it was a movie or a game or a comic book or a book or whatever it happened to be, had to go through those guys to make sure the entire universe fit together.
Yep.
And nothing was stomped on and nothing was contradictory. So I can't imagine keeping all that stuff straight.
I don't know how he does it, number one, because there's like 24 years of Elder Scrolls history. You know, Elder Scrolls Arena came out in like 1994.
Yeah.
It's a lot. So, a lot of material.
Yeah.
And does he take into account like fan fiction or any of that?
He looks
stuff?
At that stuff to kind of see what they're coming up with. Like, but there's also the novels.
Those are considered canon as well.
It's a crazy amount of stuff.
That's insane.
He has to keep in his head.
Wow. And then I might be wrong on this, but you actually have some people who date back to the old TSR days for Dungeons & Dragons, right?
We do. Actually, we have quite a few.
So this is going back to, you know, this is the 70s, right?
Yeah.
70s, early 80s?
It was definitely before I was interested in games.
Yeah. I mean, D&D has been a part of my life since I was, I don't know how old, 6-7 years old.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we've got guys.
These are the guys writing that.
We've got guys like Zeb Cook.
Yeah.
David Cook, Lawrence Schick, Bill Slavisek is another one. Ed Stark is another one that was kind of all in that part. And it's actually funny. For a while when we were ramping people up and we had those guys, they would actually bring in their Dungeons & Dragons books and get those guys to sign that stuff. So we're all nerds. Like it's really cool.
That's great.
It's really cool.
I still see people in the conference rooms at lunchtime playing D&D.
Yep.
And
yep.
I always step on dice when I'm walking to the meetings. All right. Well,
let's take a quick break.
Yeah.
We'll grab another beer and we'll be right back.
All right. All right, we have fresh beers. Although in the break, I think we already drank about half of them. But so we got to talking a little bit about the history of the video game industry. Here we sit in 2018, and we're definitely in a kinder, gentler industry than what we started in. So can you tell some of the stories about your QA experience in Canada?
Sure. I'm trying to figure out how many executive type people today are going to be incriminated by this now.
Yeah, we'll bleep out names. As you say.
Yeah, I say just say the names. We will bleep them out.
All right. I got this. we're all young and dumb. You know, that's kind of how the industry works. And, you know, young people come in and they do things and probably some of the things they shouldn't do. So, I experienced everything at EA. So we had a long, 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 long crunch period, and we built the Great Wall of soda cans. over this. We had a bunch of different SKUs or a bunch of different teams kind of close together. And we erected a wall out of soda cans out of this. And then it turned into Nerf gun wars and all the other fun things that go along. And we actually destroyed the wall, and there's a bunch of soda left in those, and we demolished a bunch of dev kits because soda got into these machines and spilled all over. Like, it was just a mess. So, you know, that's one story. Other stories of...
Well, you know, there's a reason we're doing this podcast at the bar. I think a lot of the video game industry... is the decisions are made at the bar. I've worked at companies where you couldn't make a decision unless you were slap fighting and drunk.
And these decisions, they hold up later or
sometimes.
Yeah, it depends. Yeah. It depends how deep we ended up going.
Alcohol definitely dulls the pain.
Yeah, I bet.
Definitely dulls the pain. I have a few bottles of liquor in my office that when I'm working late, I will definitely partake in.
I remember, I'll tell a quick story, because this is how the industry used to be. When I was at EA around 2000, one of our artists, who was a really funny guy, he sent this video out to the whole company, and it was a video he had made. And it started with a credit scene and just this bombastic music. It was very dramatic music. And it gave the credits of, like, this video produced by, and it named the producer at the studio, and it said audio by, and it was the audio guys at the studio. And, you know, went all the way down, art, you know, the art directors there, name by name. This was sent out, I think it was actually sent out to all of EA, because you could still do that at the time. And the credit sequence was 3 minutes long of just everybody in the company, how they of course, hadn't worked on the video.
Right.
But it was just naming these people on the video. And finally, it cuts to the video, and it's just like a two-second stick figure of a guy, like, spanking it, going, and then it stopped.
Yep.
And it went to the whole company. He didn't even get fired. They went, you should probably not.
That's incredible.
It was a different world back then. Like,
yes, it was.
I definitely remember, and I'll affectionately call it the QA McDonald's.
Okay.
Back in the day, but we used to go to a bar for lunch, and it had dancers at the bar.
A special bar,
yes. And
how does that work in Canada? Do you throw loonies and toonies at them?
I don't even remember had loonies and toonies back then.
Like, that's how
old I am now, so, which is scary. But
I remember when the toonie came out. That was about 96.
Toonie Tuesdays. Oh. Greatest thing in the world. but one of the rituals we used to do at QA McDonald's is we would take somebody to QA McDonald's for their exit interview, before their exit interview, get them absolutely hammered.
And they knew they were going to have this interview, right?
Oh, I mean, yeah. And we all knew, too, so it was even worse for them.
Right.
And we would buy them drinks, all kinds of drinks, just get them absolutely hammered, and then they would have to try to function in their exit interview.
Now, how would you know what was going on in the interview? Were you, like, outside listening, like, giggling?
No, you don't. You just
You see the aftermath?
Yes, yeah. You just hear the aftermath and see the aftermath. And this is kind of like EA... Canada mythos. This story is still told. I haven't been at EA forever.
Yeah, there are a lot of those. Yeah.
But I still have some friends there. And this is still one of those, you know, most people think it's BS, but it actually happened. And we got this guy really, really hammered one day. And he went into HR and had his exit interview and got really, really, really belligerent, which is unfortunate. And then ran out of the studio yelling and screaming, doing all these things, and passed out in the middle of the median of a freeway.
This is glorious.
It is unbelievable. And I actually just saw a Reddit thread on this where they were like, is this real? And everybody's responding, holy crap, it is real. Holy crap. So he woke up the next day, and he was in the drunk tank, and he was like, how did I get here? What happened? And it's just one of those stories that... yeah, we were young and dumb.
But let me drop back into some of the design stuff, because I wanted to get back into some of the questions that people might have on how design actually works, as opposed to this concept of, you know, the idea man. So, you know, one of the things I get a lot of times is I get people pitching games to me, and it goes from, you know, drunk fans at a bar to all the way up to, you know, I've sat with some big name Hollywood people who want to get into video games.
Yeah, but like as if you have some magic wand to... suddenly take an entire team of people and build a game.
No, yeah.
Like, it takes a team of people.
As an engineer, that's where the magic happens.
That's what we make them think.
Right.
But what I always get is when people pitch games, they pitch me the plot of the game. Mm-hmm. They spend a half an hour on, here's the plot. You're this guy, and your dad died when you were young, and you go through this adventure, and then you find out your dad's still alive, and he was the villain. And I walk out of those meetings going, I have no idea what this
game is. What the F is the game?
You could say fuck. We're on the internet.
What the fuck?
what would your advice be on something like that? Like, how would you pitch a game? I try to introduce the concept of mechanics to people. Like, a game isn't just the plot.
Right.
You need to tell me what the game is.
Yeah, it's multiple things.
Yeah.
Right? It is... What is the plot? Story is absolutely a huge part of what a game is. But what keeps people in the game playing the game is kind of that core loop. What is that core loop? Is it combat? Is it something else? And so you have to think about a lot of those things. It kind of goes back to that door problem that we talked about a little bit earlier. Yeah. Is what the F is a door in this game? You know, how does it move? How does it sound? How does it look? You know, does it move the player when they try to push against it? All of those things. And so the ultimate goal as a designer is to figure out what that core loop is. What is that sticky thing that keeps people coming back and playing over and over and over and over again?
Yeah, you know, when I think of games being designed, again, as a tech guy, I think of the core components. You know, is this a first-person shooter?
Yep.
What are the weapons? You know, is there melee combat? You know, is there jumping? Is there flying? Are there vehicles? And when I hear a game pitch, those are the things that I want to hear. I don't necessarily, as somebody who builds the inner workings of the game, I don't really care about what the plot is. It doesn't matter. I know it's important to the end user, but to me, you know, I want to hear what those mechanics are. And I think you probably know this better than I do. A lot of designers will come up with kind of pillars of a game. Mm-hmm. And how does that, like, what would a pillar of ESO be?
So it's funny, that's one of the things that we had to work through over the years is, you know, what is, and I'll take combat as an example, what are the core pillars of combat in ESO? And we break it down by, you know, it's fast-paced, action-oriented. Well, what does fast-paced, action-oriented mean?
Sure.
Right? So that is, you know, no cooldowns. You're managing resources, so you're always kind of going through and reacting to the world. You're playing the world and not playing the UI. It's that level of detail when you start digging into those types of things.
Yeah, I've always found it fascinating. Again, I see the inner workings of this stuff, but even talking about a game that I'm working on or a game that I have worked on, people say, well, you know, I wish you would have just given me this. I wish in Elder Scrolls Online you just would have given me, you know, a crossbow or whatever it happens to be. But... It's fascinating to me how designers go in and balance all of this stuff. Like, balance is so important, and maybe we can talk a little bit about how you balance a game.
I find that fascinating because there's so many variables. How do you know that one thing is going to throw the entire system off? And I guess that sometimes that does happen, right? And you have to, what do you call it? You got to nerf certain.
Yeah.
Weapons.
Nerf, there you go. You got it. Yeah, nerf. Yeah.
You hear about that all the time.
So balance is a really difficult thing
in
any game. And in Elder Scrolls Online, one of the things that kind of helps us a little bit is players don't have access to every single thing in the game at the same time. So there's some other games where you have 75 different hot buttons that you have to play with and whatnot. But in Elder Scrolls Online, you have 12. You have six on your front bar, six on your back bar. And so it's kind of like a deck building game when you're going through and kind of putting things together. That helps reduce some of the complexities. But where we add in all the complexities is we have different item sets. There's 280 some odd item sets in the game.
Right.
We have champion points, which go up to 270. And there's 9 different stars that you can play with. There are also all the different abilities that you can mix and match and put in and discover as well. And so it's not just your class, but it's also how you build your character with skills, how you build your character with your different champion points, as well as your traits. And it all kind of compounds. And it is a really, really, really complex problem.
I've been amazed just reading some of the feedback on ESO. how the players figure out some of this stuff. I mean, players will know.
They're unbelievable. All
do they, of the I numbers. Imagine that they just, it's like rote. They just hammer it until they kind of find those vulnerabilities.
There are players that have gotten so good at reverse engineering our combat formulas that they get within like 1% of some of the stuff.
That's amazing.
Which is unbelievable because they don't know what the F. Well, sorry. They don't know how the combat formulas work, but based on their empirical data, they're able to reverse engineer our combat formulas.
Do you hire those people?
I mean, that's
impressive.
We
actually did. Yeah. We did. We hired one of our combat designers who's moved on to go back to school. She was an influencer, a streamer. Mm-hmm. And I was watching her one day, and she had her Excel spreadsheet out, and she was showing all the math, and I'm like, holy shit, this woman is freaking smart. We should hire her. And we hired her, and she ended up building our Warden class.
Right.
And then she ended up deciding that she wanted to go and do something else, and so she did that. But, yeah, that has happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the tech side, you know, we do the same thing. If somebody's able to hack our game, the first thing we try to do is actually go and grab that person. You could either work for security and tell us did that, or we'll have we'll enforce
Make
our end
smarter,
user license
please.
Agreement. Yeah, that definitely happens. Well, and let me ask you about this because this is really foreign to me. I come from mainly a background. You know, I started in the early 90s, and I come from the console space. And for most of my career, games have been fire and forget. You know, you ship a game.
Games as a service.
So you ship a game and it's done. You don't get any feedback until it's out there. And if you made mistakes, well, too bad. You can't fix them. You couldn't patch games for the longest time. So now you have this concept of a game as a service. How is it dealing with the community? I get to sit behind this nice wall of technology where they never let me talk to the community. They never let me talk to players. And I've learned not to read anything because the opinions can be so
polarizing.
Volatile and so harsh sometimes that it actually makes me feel bad. So I stay away from
it
that.
Does, yeah.
But you have to be on the forefront of that. So how do you manage that?
Lots of alcohol. No, I mean, in all seriousness, you kind of start to build up that wall after a while. And ultimately what you're looking for when you're reading that feedback is, where is that nugget of truth in there? Everybody is passionate about the game. You know, people, even if they say they hate the game, there's a reason why they're on the forums or on Reddit or on Twitter or whatever posting about your game. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to take that information and try to distill it into, well, what is it they are ultimately complaining about? Mm-hmm. And it's hard because a lot of times it's vitriol and they're attacking your mother.
Right. Oh, we've had death threats before at different companies.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely a big thing. And players' passions kind of get out of control. And they, you know, because of the anonymity of the internet, it's fine to say, I want to kill you. And there's a real person on the other end of that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People don't really recognize that. So it's really hard as a developer to kind of take that and try to read that and then try to turn that into actionable feedback.
Yeah. You know, the only thing I really do get is I get the crash dumps, the crash reports. So when games crash nowadays, the systems a lot of times will send a report back to the engineers.
Does it do this automatically, like sort of under the hood?
It can. Yeah. So the consoles do sometimes, but there are also systems where you're allowed as a player to type in notes. And it's really meant for, you know, here's what I was doing.
I bet these notes are.
That's
great.
Not how they turn out. Trust me, I've read this.
I have been both laughing and crying in my office before, looking at some of the comments people put in these crash dumps. So for people out there that are listening, if you're wondering if people see that stuff, yes, they do.
They do.
Every single day. Yes, every single day.
They're
There's a real person reading that stuff every single day, and sometimes their job sucks.
Well, ESO has a dedicated community team where their entire job is to deal with the community, and they're on Reddit with people, and they're on the forums, and
they are our saviors, and I honestly don't know how they do it.
Do they also drink heavily?
No. I mean, I think they would love
busy?
To.
Yeah.
They're too busy to.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I could deal with that job.
No. It takes a special person to do that, to keep getting kicked in the balls all the time.
That's harsh. Well, let me jump a little bit now. One of the reasons we started this podcast is I'm sure you get this all the time, and I get it all the time, at least once a week, and most times more. I get some email from a friend that says I have a son or a daughter or a cousin. My mom emailed me a couple weeks ago, true story, wow, about how her friend at the hair salon had a neighbor's kid who wants to get into video games. And, you know, I think it's
a small world.
Yeah. Well, and I think the way games are made and you know, the inner workings of game studios are largely still unknown. So you're a hiring manager for designers, as am I. And I've always wondered, when I go to hire an engineer, there's kind of a checklist that you could have. Right. You know, you need to know C++, and you need to know, you know, these software packages. And
I failed both those, by the way.
I never took them. Don't tell anybody. You know, there is at least some sort of a checklist. But with design, there is no checklist. There's no what do you look for when you get a resume of a designer?
Sure. So there is a checklist, okay, at least for me. And the checklist that I have is... number one is the passion. How do they show their passion for game design? And that can come out a bunch of different ways, mm-hmm, but ultimately it kind of goes back to their portfolio.
So you would expect somebody coming in off the street brand new to have some sort of a portfolio.
Yeah, what do you do? What do you love to do? You know, do you have examples of mods, of mm-hmm, creative writing, of game systems? Mm-hmm. Like that to me separates the people that have a degree from the people that are passionate. Okay. About it.
And, you know, one thing I try to stress is that making games isn't like playing games. You know,
It's very different.
I get a lot of people who go, I love playing games. Yep. You know, how do I make them? And it's like, well, it's a way different problem set.
It is. And I was actually on the other side of the fence at the time, which is I loved playing games. Mm-hmm. I had no idea this was a real industry at the time.
Right, right.
And so I didn't know what to expect, and that's why I spent all the time I spent in QA was trying to figure out how this works and whatnot. But ultimately, a game designer, when you go in and you're playing a game, it's really hard to just enjoy the game, to turn that kind of designer brain off and play the game. A lot of times what you're doing when you're playing through a game is, well, why did they make that decision?
You know,
I wonder how do I break this?
I am the worst person to play games with now because all I do is I take them apart. I ruin the fun.
And it's really hard. And
is it always that way, or do you lose yourself sometimes really good game?
It depends
a game that really
on the
touches
game.
You.
It absolutely depends on the game. So I think the best example of me losing myself in a game is probably Horizon Zero Dawn.
Mm, sure.
So I binged on that game. Spent 50 hours in a week on that game. And I was just mesmerized by how they did their world building, how they did their storytelling, how their combat worked, and how tight the controls were in the game. And I forgot my designer, in my inner designer, and I was just able to sit down and enjoy the game. And that is very, very rare at this point for me.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy how that happens. Most of the games I enjoy now are PC strategy games, mm-hmm, because I've never made them. If I look at any game in a genre where I've worked before, I instantly go into the tech behind it, and I can see bugs, and I can see graphic anomalies, and I can see
the
scenes between.
That's me with sports games.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what I did at EA for the longest time. Yep. You know, I still have a really difficult time trying to jump in and play an NHL hockey, yep, or a triple play baseball, or, well, I guess it's not triple play anymore, but. Or any kind of the sports games that I played for so long or tested for so long at EA, it's really hard for me to get in there. And so, yeah, I gravitate towards the RPGs and, mm-hmm, and the strategies. And one of my favorite things is to jump onto, you know, websites like Kongregate or like Armor Games and just see what the indie developers are doing and what they're building, mm-hmm, because they have so much freedom to kind of build whatever they want and just kind of put it out there and see what people think and then iterate on that stuff really quickly.
Mm-hmm. So I was back in Seattle, I think last week, and I had lunch with a friend and his son who I think it was just graduating from high school, and he wanted to get into games, but he's thinking about going to a couple of the different big video game schools,
okay,
which we didn't have when we were coming up. Nobody taught.
No.
What are those schools? Where are they?
There's a whole bunch out there. Yeah. So, you know, Full Sail is one that a lot of people talk about.
Digipen
is another one.
I mean, you guys.
The Guild Hall at SMU is another another big one that we've had actually a lot of success at with.
Yeah, I was going to ask how many people that you see come out of those sort of institutions do you find being as qualified with that sort of passion you're talking about compared to somebody who maybe didn't go to school?
It depends. Again, like we've had really good success at SMU.
Right.
But when I look at, you know, some of our core people, some of those people didn't really go to school for that kind of stuff. You know, my lead content designer on ESO, Jeremy Serra, him and his buddies kind of had a little startup that they created some games, but it wasn't really successful. And so he was actually doing a lot of IT work at the time, but he had this passion and this drive to make games, and he made one of the largest Oblivion mods at the time, where him and his buddies and his wife would record, I think they recorded something ridiculous, like 100,000 lines of dialogue.
That's insane.
It's insane what they did, and not all of it was fantastic, but it showed that passion, and what he had built was unbelievable, and we hired him. And he's been with us for like 8 years now at this point. Wow. And he's the head of the content team now.
Right.
Yeah, you know, one thing I tell anybody trying to get in, but especially designers, is, you know, you can come out with a degree, but what we're looking for is we're looking for design.
Yes.
Get Unreal. You know, get Unity. Design.
There's so many resources out there today, right, for like an indie developer doesn't know much, but to learn. Sort of all the working parts and pieces. Yeah,
there's an unbelievable number of editors out there,
and
showing that kind of passion for me is I'm modding various games. I'm going in and playing everything under the sun. I'm able to go in and kind of dissect why people are making the decisions they're making in some of their game systems or some of their stories or how they're doing that kind of stuff. That's what I mean by passion.
Like, right.
The thing that doesn't interest me as a hiring manager is somebody that doesn't play games. Like, if you're not playing games,
right,
it's really hard to be a good designer.
Mm-hmm. I think that's totally true. You know, on the tech side, I look for people who are building just things, even if it's engines or problems. Our graphics programmer right now, he goes home after working an 8 to 10 hour day and he works on his own graphics engine. He just loves doing that.
Right.
And you know, there are so many people out there wanting to do it now and so many people that are able to mod that's really what new entries into the game industry are dealing with. You have to design. You need to come in with levels that you've built or you know, even stories that you've built or mechanics that you've tried, and you need to be able to show that. If you just come in with a piece of paper that says you graduated from a school, it actually doesn't really matter to us.
No.
It might get your foot in the door.
Right. To me, the filter when I get, you know, 100 resumes is, what does their portfolio look like?
Mm-hmm.
How do they show me that they are interested in game design?
Right. Let me ask you this, because I've told a few people this and they were flabbergasted by it. When you're going through that initial sort of resumes, I know you get resumes on your desk all the time. How long do you spend on each resume for the initial sort?
Oh, boy. Do I want to answer that question? Probably no more than a minute.
See, I'm 10 seconds, really.
Probably no more minute. So for me, really what I look for is, show me where your portfolio is in here. And so I will go through the resume until I find the portfolio, and then I go and click on that, and then I go and try and look at that. And so it's about a minute. If there's no portfolio, it goes straight to the round file.
Yeah, exactly. It's about 10 or 15 seconds for me that where I could comb through a resume and at least go, this guy is interesting, or I'm not at all interested.
Right. Yep.
So, you know, advice to anybody trying to submit a resume to a game company, that you got to grab us in a very short amount of time. If you're an entry level candidate and you write a 5-page resume, I don't have the time to read through it. I'm sorry.
I kind of hate reading.
Yeah.
I mean, which is hilarious when you think about it, because, you know, a lot of my designers write 75-page design docs, but I hate reading. So, you know, make me interested in you in the first page.
Yeah, I think that's definitely good advice. And I think the important thing there, I see a lot of QA guys who come in And they think because they're in QA and because they've been there for 2 years, they deserve a production position or a design position. Mm-hmm. And what frustrates me is here are guys who have access to the tools. They have access to the level editors in the game. And if you want to be a designer, stay a couple hours and make a level in the game.
Yep.
We'll let you do it. And a lot of people don't do that. They think because they put in their couple hours.
It goes back to that passion thing that I talked about earlier, right? Yeah. Which is you have an inside track on all of that stuff. Show that passion. Mm-hmm. Demonstrate that you love making games. Mm-hmm. That is the most important thing, in my opinion, as a hiring manager, is where is that passion? Everybody is smart now. Everybody has great ideas.
Yep. Yeah, that's very
true. How do you demonstrate that you have great ideas? You mod, you build stuff, you tinker.
Yep.
Sometimes you have this brilliant idea that you think is the most unbelievable thing in the world, and you put it in front of people, and they're like, that is shit. What the fuck is wrong with you? And
right.
You have to take that and go, okay,
yeah.
This was the thing I was the most proud of. How do I make it better?
Yeah.
And that's a really, really hard thing as a designer. And it's magnified when it's a bigger game mm-hmm. or when you're in an online game, when you have a lot of people, is everybody has an opinion and everybody thinks they're a designer. You know, yeah. I personally don't think I'm an engineer. So when an engineer comes to me and says, that's bullshit, I can't do that, I go, okay. Mm-hmm. Same thing with an artist. I have zero art talent. I can draw a stick figure pretty good, but that's about it. Mm-hmm. But everybody thinks they have great ideas, and everybody thinks they understand how to design a game. And it's really hard to kind of dig through that feedback and iterate on things as you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, if you are out there and you are building levels or modding games or whatever, that's a very important part of it, is putting it in front of people.
And it's the hardest. It's the most vulnerable time a designer is, here's my best guess at what is going to work.
Yeah.
Tell me if it works.
And believe me, in this industry, people are brutal.
Oh, yeah.
Especially engineers. Oh, yeah. I know, you know, coming from an engineering background and managing engineers, engineers in the industry are wickedly smart people. We have some genius level people, and they do not pull punches on some of this stuff. They have no ability to empathize with your feelings.
We call those soft skills.
They will go. We don't hire engineers based on soft skills, right. Unfortunately. it's an important skill to have, and you know, at some point, you build up, I guess, a bit of callousness towards it, but
you have a wall.
You need to be able to take that feedback. Yep. If you're going to get criticism on your ideas and run into a corner, what are you going to do when 100,000 people on Reddit are telling you?
It is
you
the
suck?
Hardest thing to do as a designer is to take critical feedback. And there's a difference between critical and just straight up rude.
Straight
right?
up attack.
You're a fucking idiot and I want to kill your mom. Well, that you can't really react about. But, you know, I hate this thing because of whatever. Mm-hmm. That is good feedback. And that is something that every designer has to learn how to take, is when somebody says they don't like something. Mm-hmm. You know, you tend to kind of go into that shell and be really defensive. Well, this is why this idea is so brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to listen to what people are telling you about why they don't like something.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the industry now, from the smallest games to the biggest games, you're not an island. You're never working alone.
Right.
And you never get to be a dictator on all of this stuff. You're always going to have feedback. You're always going to have to collaborate with people who have other ideas. So, learn.
Two heads are better than one. Four heads are better than two, right? Like, the more you iterate on something, the better it is going to get.
Mm-hmm. So, learn how to fail and learn how to pick yourself back up.
Learn how
do
to
it
fail
all the
gracefully
time.
Is the most important part.
And early and often.
All right. Well, Rich, I just want to cheers you too. Thank you for being a part of our first podcast.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Guys, this is a shit ton of fun.
Absolutely.
I'm having a blast.
You need a cheers sound on your soundboard.
I know. I don't have that. Yeah, I don't have that. I got something. I don't know. Maybe.
There you go. Good old Mario. Oh, such a great sound.
To wrap this up, I actually wanted to talk to you a little bit about where games are going, because you're a creative director in games. I mean, you don't get much higher than that nowadays, and I have a feeling...
There's a few other levels above them, but... Yeah.
But I have a feeling you're going to be directing games for a long time to come. Where do you see where do you see the industry going? We've had so many things, you know, online is even a relatively new thing for us.
It is, absolutely.
And, you know, we have VR going, we have AR coming in. What, you know, we have the luxury of seeing some games that are coming out in 2022, 2023 in development, yep, that of course we can't talk about, but what do you see as the next big things? Where do you see this going?
So I think the big things for gamers in general are going to be the social hooks, what keeps you in, you know, you're playing the game because your friends are playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then another big part is going to be kind of that AR. You know, everybody wants to get to, I want a holodeck.
Yep.
Which I think is a ways off at this point, but, you know, that augmented reality, I think, is going to be a big part. And then tie all of that in with mobile.
Okay.
So everybody has a phone. I affectionately refer to it as a nerd phone because it solves so many nerdy arguments. You know, I just look it up on the internet. It's right there in my hands. But that is such a huge boom and a huge market. And pretty much everybody has a phone now. And so that tie-in to always on, always there, easy accessibility, I think those are all kind of the big things kind of coming up.
From a design perspective, what is the sort of best unexpected success story that you, something you didn't expect to be successful in whatever way, but it ended up being so?
There's so many, and I think that the arrow thing is the biggest.
Yeah.
You know, in Oblivion, in the tutorial, you're, you know, taking target practice and you're shooting this bucket in the tutorial, and the arrow sticks in the bucket. And Todd's thing was, we didn't kind of intend that to happen, and it just kind of stayed there, and it was a bug, and it was staying in the world, and you could go up and you could pick it and you could put it back in your inventory, and that felt really good. It felt like the world was alive. And they kept it.
You know, I worked on a racing game years ago that never shipped. It ended up getting canceled, but it was kind of a stunt driving game, and you know, we ran these levels in development just ad nauseum. We would just play through these levels, and you know, they're kind of linear driving levels where you had a bunch of obstacles, and we just played them, and the game was okay, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sticky. It didn't have that fun factor that you really want. And at some point, we just got bored with the thing, and we actually decided to try to run the levels backwards. So we were running the levels backwards, and it turns out we had bugs in our physics systems.
That breaks stuff all the time.
But what was cool is you would hit these jumps backwards with your car, and your car would launch off into the air, and it'd do flips, and it would tumble and get damaged. And we ended up playing that for hours, just seeing how far you can get on this physics bug and how cool it was. Like, how much can you damage your car with like one crash? And it completely changed the entire game just because of this accidental find.
That happens more than we would like to admit. But yeah, we see that in Elder Scrolls Online all the time. You know, especially in, I'll use an example of our dungeons. A lot of times when we build encounters, we have this kind of process in our head where here's how players will react to all of the things that are going on in the dungeon. And we build the encounter to suit that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets on live, you know, it gets all the way through the process, you know, through QA, through PTS, which is our public test server, and then onto live. And then you get millions of players out there playing it, and somebody does something unexpected, and you're like, well, shit. The monster just stands there and does nothing. Mm-hmm. That's not intended, and we have to figure out how to address that.
Well, a lot of that might also be due to maybe just not giving enough time to test everything you have to, which also brings me to a question. What's like your worst sort of deadline story where you were a crunch time, you had to get something out, and it ended up, you didn't think it was going to be a big deal, but it ended up being maybe a big deal. And maybe you can't talk about that. I don't know, but I'm curious about
it. I can.
From a production side, I'm curious about that.
So one of the things that was one of our core pillars before launch was the player effects change in the world. And so we had this really cool concept of, you do something in the world changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. It works fantastic in a single player game.
Sure.
In a multiplayer game, when you have to worry about your friends, doesn't work quite as well because you're separating other players, you're separating your group mates from being able to play together. And so that was one of the things we spent probably 6-8 months after launch trying to solve was this whole concept of how do we make the world feel like I am making a change to it based on my choices?
Mm-hmm.
And do it in such a way that we aren't separating group mates from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard. We had, you know, if you save the princess, for instance, you would see this one version of a city, which is populated with friendlies and has all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And then if you chose another, you know, another angle, the city would still be infested with hostiles. And so you were not on the same kind of step and you couldn't see your friends. And that was really, really hard. And that was a hard lesson that we learned at launch.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was kind of the bane of my existence at launch for quite a while.
You're making my tech director programmer head spin. How in the hell I would design all this stuff out to make it work. So one last question for you. I know we're getting kind of drunk and it's getting kind of late.
I still have a long way to go.
Yeah, and you do still have a very long way to go. Thank you for coming down here. But I'm not going to make you tell us about your hopes and dreams, but is there a Rich Lambert game around that head somewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And
what is it? No, I'm curious.
Oh, man. I'm not telling anybody. But,
okay.
So my passion is massively multiplayer games. That is the thing that I've always wanted to do. My first taste of that was Ultima Online. Way mm-hmm. back in the day, I got to test a little bit of it. I loved it. It was the most magical thing in the world where everybody that I saw in the world was another player. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I met my wife playing massively multiplayer games.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We've been married 16 years. I have a whole bunch of kids, probably more than I should have.
But a couple dogs, too, some pictures.
I do. Well, they're actually horses. I have Great Danes.
They're big.
Yeah. I have two Great Danes and a Corgi. So I have the monster truck and the lowrider version of dogs. But I'm really passionate about online worlds. I'm really passionate about the social aspects, the social bonds that you develop with other players across the world. And so the game that I have in my head is definitely playing heavily on those social bonds mm-hmm. of, you know, exploration, of, you know, adding to the RPG kind of mechanics where I'm building my character. Like, I love all of those aspects of games.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will, for one thing, I hope we see that someday. I think there's a lot of exciting stuff coming up and you know, as a video game maker on the tech side, I'm fascinated to hopefully help you figure out some of those challenges and put it together someday.
Because I don't know how the hell I'm going to do it.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up. For anybody who listened to this, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll have more later.
If you like the podcast, if you've got questions, you got suggestions for us, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at drinks@d3podcast.com or by visiting the social media links in the show description.
All righty. Well, thanks for coming out, Rich. We do
thank
appreciate
you, Rich.
It.
Thank you so much.
And, I had so much fun, guys.
All right,
this
well,
was a blast.
We're going to do it again.
You know where to find us.
Sign me up. I'm all for this.
Awesome.
Free beer and talking about all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah. It's great.
All right. Well, until next time, this is the Drunk Developer Diaries podcast signing off.